Good morning. We are here at 7:40 on the Mighty 690, and it is time for a Friday legislative update for you. And joining us, we have State Representative Ron Bryce in studio. Good morning, Ron. How are you doing?
Good morning. Great to be here.
Hey, good to have you. So, you know, it's another fall weekend we're getting into here in the area. So much going on, and I know so many activities. So,
right.
And match day yesterday, boy, oh boy.
Yeah.
That was crazy.
Yeah. It really was. I'm glad to see the giving spirit that everyone has this time of year. And legislatively, it's been a little bit slower just because the session doesn't start for about 6 or 7 more weeks. But as soon as it does start, I know we'll be drinking from a fire hose, so to speak, as far as legislation goes. But I've been able to meet with several people. I was able to speak on the steps of the Capitol at a rally for Protect Our Children. It's a national event. Was able to speak at a veterans banquet recently. And when I see these veterans, you know, for the most part, it's older men. And I just wanted to inspire them to keep their warrior spirit and stand up and fight for the things they believe in, for their values. And I'm just so inspired by those men. But also, there was this week a housing conference in Independence, which I think was a big issue for Southeast Kansas, because as you know, we have a housing problem. In fact, that's why one of the main reasons Lydia and I moved back to Montgomery County several years ago. We saw the need for housing and the old houses that some were falling down, and we ended up buying at auction many houses, and our family, all 4 of our kids got involved. We repaired those houses, and so it's on our heart to have housing for the area. And I think it was a very good event that the lieutenant governor was there. He spoke, and there are many programs available, and it was good to just get tabs on all these programs. And I think it can be beneficial for not only Coffeyville, but all of Montgomery County.
No, that is for sure. And, you know, being able to, yeah, new houses would be nice, but there's still a lot of old houses that if we act sooner rather than later can still be saved. I mean, a lot of them are already kind of past that tipping point, unfortunately, but
yeah.
There's still plenty that could be saved and brought back to something usable.
Yeah, and that is on a lot of people's minds, because we want economic development, I should say. But do you need housing to bring in businesses, to bring in jobs, but then you need jobs in order to build the housing? It's kind of a chicken or the egg kind of thing. But I'm real proud of local people have been building houses. There's a new house going up over on Woodland toward Deering. There's 7 new houses behind the bowling alley on Edgewood here in Coffeyville. And I think that's a positive sign for the area.
Sure, for sure. Well, you know, another thing that is very important to economic development and life in general is water. And in fact, we did actually have Caney make the Wall Street Journal here. So some, you know, familiar names like Blake Vargas actually being quoted in the story that was, I believe, in yesterday's edition of the Wall Street Journal, just highlighting some areas around the country that are dealing with conditions drier than the Dust Bowl is what the article calls it. But, you know, nothing that our listeners don't necessarily know about, you know, as far as the Caney situation, but bringing some of that into the national spotlight.
That's amazing that Caney was in the Wall Street Journal. I know they wish they were in the Wall Street Journal for other reasons, but the water issue has been front and center for some time, and I think this recent crisis is something that has really motivated people to have a long-term solution. I'm not sure the final long-term solution has been found, but I know it's affecting everyone's lives, and some people are actually a little fearful in the Caney area. There's they've closed down car wash. I think they have 4-day school week.
Yep.
Because the school district actually is the biggest consumer of water, I hear. The riverbed's dry in the Little Caney River, and they, unlike other towns in Southeast Kansas, they don't really have a reservoir from the Army Corps of Engineers to draw from as a secondary backup. And so it's going to be something that, you know, there are some funds available on the state level, and I'm sure Representative Blex, who is the Caney representative, and Virgil Peck, the senator, will be working with the state government to try and find a long-term solution. But it is a little, makes people a little anxious. You know, I have friends over there. My daughter is actually looking at a house, possibly moving to Caney. And just the water situation affects the economy, affects the people's mindset, affects the whole town. So we just pray that there will be a resolution of this immediate water shortage and to have a long-term solution. Hopefully the state government will be able to help out some with that.
Well, and another quote here in this article apparently is that something that hasn't really, that I haven't heard quite as much talked about in Caney, is that according to the director of the Kansas Water Office, Connie Owen, Caney's municipal water distribution system has many leaks, and that their amount of unaccounted water could be as high as 50%, which is wild.
Wow.
So that's some new information that I hadn't necessarily heard before. That's according, again, to the Kansas Water Office. So
yeah.
I know that they've been working on patching some of those leaks. And, I mean, pretty much every summer is really actually the time when we have a lot of leaks. I mean, winter can be too, but kind of counterintuitive there. But
yeah. I know that is a problem. I'm surprised it's 50%.
That's according, again, to the Kansas Water Office. So I'd have to double check that statistic myself, but that's according to the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, part of the solution is going to be just replacing those leaky lines. I'm sure 50, 70, 80-year-old water lines need to be retrofitted, you know, to have something more efficient.
Sure. Well, anyway, switching gears just a little bit, I know that we have had a few articles here recently, kind of some updates on the Kansas court system computer hack. Have you heard anything else regarding this? I know it still kind of continues, and I know some of these different counties are kind of, they've had to resort to some backup systems here, even if that is just, you know, pen and paper.
Yeah, and as an older guy, I kind of found it interesting that one of the articles said that the older lawyers were teaching the younger lawyers how to use a fax machine, pen and paper on some of these filings. So I don't know why that amused
me. Well, if you think historically, courts and lawyers have always been the last to adopt this digital stuff, it seems like.
Yeah.
You know, I believe that actually law offices are one of the biggest users besides the medical field of still faxes and,
yeah,
and everything.
Yeah, we still on occasion fax things. We use e-fax sometimes to do a medical record request or what have you. But one thing I did find that I don't know how much it's been discussed here on KGGF, but this is not exactly a new problem. There, since 2018, I believe it is, there have been 18 different court systems that were attacked by ransomware, malware across the country. I know Alaska's courts went offline in 2021. Texas had a ransomware attack in 2020. Georgia had some court websites down in 2019. And more the reports that I hear are that at first they were just saying, well, it could be a bug. We don't know. We're not going to say. But it looks more and more that it is a ransomware type of situation, which to me, that's ominous that not our entire court system, Johnson County, for reasons that we can discuss, but they're not affected by this. But the statewide court system otherwise is, and it not only affects the lawyers and the cases that they're trying. I have constituents who have emailed me and contacted me that have, let's say, a payday loan office or something to do with automobile licensing, or where they have to do background checks or court documents to check up on people. And one of them told me he was on the verge of going bankrupt because he couldn't conduct business. And so it's not just affecting, you know, we kind of think we're insulated from it. It's just these courts, these guys in the black robes somewhere in Topeka. But it's affecting everyday people. And I can't get my mind, honestly, James, I can't get my mind around the fact that some people would want to just, maybe they just want the money on ransomware. And we can discuss what ransomware is. But maybe they just want to put a spoke in the wheel, you know, stick in the spokes of the wheel of the state government. But it's beyond me why people would want to do that. But it's something that we actually did know. There was an audit a couple of years ago about the state court system computers, and that's sealed, and we can't get the information from that. But a couple of other agency audits since then have shown that appears to be security issues with all of the state computers. So there was some forewarning on this. I hope that it's not a ransomware type attack. Who knows, you know, some guy in China or Belarus or even, you know, Kansas City just doing a, trying to make a few million bucks off of this. But we live in a time now, and I guess my way of relating to this, like you mentioned, I'm a medical doctor, so I deal with medical records. And I remember back in the day, medical records was all paper.
Yeah, just those, you know, you walk into an office, it'd be all those files right behind the desk there.
It was a completely different animal back then. And if you, in the basement of a hospital, the medical records department was kind of like this cave with just stacks and stacks of charts and papers. And you always hated being called down there to sign charts because you'd have to rummage through all that stuff. But recent years, the last 10 or 20 years particularly, we switched over mostly to electronic systems, and that's apparently what's happened in the court systems, where it's all stored online. And there are some positives for that, because you have economies of scale where people can access vast information and have access to different files rapidly, and there's some good aspects of that. But on the downside is, when it all goes down, it can be devastating. And for me, I guess my personal experience in the medical field would be, you know, I like having paper and then back it up digitally. Mm-hmm. I'm a belt and suspenders kind of guy. You know, you ever see these old guys? it's almost always a guy. He has a belt and suspenders. He wants a second backup plan.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
And
no.
So I'm kind of a backup plan guy. And when we've done medical offices, we've done paper. We have it on hand, and we also have backup in case the building burns down or what have
you.
We have a backup. But something like that needs to happen with the court system, at least some better security and some better backup systems, it looks
like.
And
I mean, I know that something like a paper, you know, library like that, yeah, it's going to take up a lot of space. But here's the other thing that we don't really think about. And this just goes into the way we archive stuff as a human race right now. A computer has to be on and powered all the time, and you can store stuff on a hard drive, but that magnetic storage actually, it kind of does have a shelf life. And I know paper has issues too, but actually paper is one of the longest and easiest ways you can store things, because you have to remember all of this, you know, you have to keep that technology up. You give me a hard drive that's 20 years old, and good luck trying to find a computer that can read it in these days. So things move so fast. That's why, I print out a lot of stuff.
Oh, you reminded me, I love old electronics. I know you do. Mm-hmm. You do too. But, I think we have a mixed blessing with modern electronics. We have something like this happen that could alter people's lives, but at the same time, we have ease of access. And so it's something we have to live through, and I know my children and grandchildren are going to have to face with this even more than me, but it's something that we need to work on.
Sure. Well, we got about 6 minutes left together here with Representative Ron Brister. What's another topic here that you think arises to your attention that you want to hit with our listeners this morning?
Well, I think one of the biggest issues coming up in this legislative session, by the way, the legislature will start meeting the second Monday in January, which I believe is the 8th, and it will go through sometime in April, and then perhaps a veto session after that into May. But we'll be very, very busy during that time, and the governor's office has signaled that one of their top priorities will be Medicaid expansion. And that's something that came up. I was a first-year legislator last year, and I know several times there was an attempt to get Medicaid expansion before a hearing or as an amendment to a bill on the floor. And it was always blocked by leadership. And I've delved into this a little bit, because not only am I a legislator who's going to deal with potential Medicaid expansion, but I've also been a physician and dealt with Medicaid on a very, you know, as a provider. And so I have that aspect of it. I see positives with Medicaid expansion. I see negatives with Medicaid expansion. And the positives are, at least, and one thing that bothers me is the people who are promoting Medicaid expansion mention the positives, but it's one-sided, and the negatives aren't mentioned. And that's a red flag for me. And the people who are opposed to Medicaid expansion sometimes do the same thing, but I think it's such a mixed issue. But one of the reasons that it bothers me is it's been promoted as a way to help poor people who are sick. But it's really not that. The expansion part of it, actually, people who are poor already qualify for Medicaid. And we need to work on that as far as people with disabilities on waivers and so forth. But that wouldn't even be approached by Medicaid expansion. The Medicaid expansion would take able-bodied people who are adults and have no dependents and would provide them with medical care without a work requirement. And to me, that verges on a moral issue for me. I want to help people, but if people are not willing to work, I don't think taking money from hardworking taxpayers and providing them with health care is necessarily a positive thing. Also, Medicaid expansion is billed as a way to save rural hospitals. And I've looked into that because I've worked in rural hospitals. My heart, actually, James, I've spent 40 years, almost 40 years of my life, treating sick, poor people. I've been under bridges. You know, my little black bag, doctor bag, I've taken under bridges and highways at night to encampments of homeless people in major cities. I helped start a medical outreach in Los Angeles. I did one in the Dallas area. I started a free clinic that was a Christian clinic in Shreveport. So my heart, I'm just saying that to say that my heart is for these people that are hurting. I'm just not sure Medicaid expansion is the way to go. In the rural hospitals, my heart is with them, but in states that have already had Medicaid expansion, the closure rate of rural hospitals goes up, not down. And that's a little counterintuitive because you think, oh, well, there'll be more people with insurance. But it turns out 40% of Medicaid expansion takes people off of private insurance that pays hospitals. It moves them to Medicaid, which only pays at best 90%. And so the hospitals end up closing at a faster rate when Medicaid expansion happens. And there's a lot of marketing and salesmanship with this thing. And I know the governor's been all over the state, and the lieutenant governor. I'm actually going to be at a panel, a round table, debating lieutenant governor on Medicaid expansion in Parsons in a couple of weeks. And I'm really looking forward to that because I really do want to see some answers to the questions that I have, the negative side of Medicaid expansion. We all want to help poor people. We all want to help people who can't help themselves. But when we take taxpayer money that people have earned with their blood, sweat, and tears, and we give it to people who can work but don't, who don't have dependents, to me, that's a problem.
Well, and I think that, you know, right now, most people would probably agree that it's the American healthcare system is has a lot of challenges as far as, you know, you mentioned the rural hospitals, and then, you know, hardworking, you know, folks like us, you know, we pay into insurance every month, and then when we go to the doctor, we still have to pay a bill. So it's like, you know, other than having something catastrophic, it's still a lot is being paid into that.
Yeah, the financing of healthcare insurance is very convoluted, and it seems to be confusing on purpose. I mean, not to be a conspiracy theorist, but it seems to be, it plays on the emotions of people who want to help the poor, who want to help the sick, and it moves money and finances and power to bureaucracies, and that's the wrong trend as far as I'm concerned. I know the state government, you know, it still bugs me that the state government has in a checking account something like $4 billion of taxpayer money and another $1.6 or $1.7 billion of rainy day fund. And we weren't able to pass tax cuts to give money back to the people who pay that in. I think this is, you know, the trend toward building up the resources rather than giving the resources back to the taxpayer is just wrong.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much, Representative Ron Bryce, for joining us. We got news coming up here on KGGF Coffeeville.